So good evening. Welcome to Narsil in Action. I'm Larry, and we're gathering for this special program this evening. And I'll be co-hosting this program with Teresa Robertson, who is our Narsil contact in Pennsylvania. And we also want to recognize in the background who's making a lot of these nice things happen, Andy, and thank you for your technical expertise and assistance in making this program possible. Tonight, we're going to be focusing on some really good news from the U.S. Supreme Court, which will impact thousands of registered citizens in the state of Pennsylvania. We plan to stay on the call for 3 hours, and you're wondering if we expect you to actually stay here, and we hope you do, but we understand that some of you can't. But look at our schedule. It was emailed to everybody who signed up just shy of 4 hours ago, and actually it was emailed to you twice. My twitching finger, I wasn't detecting that the system was accepting the command, so I hit a second command, so those who signed up would have gotten 2 emails with instructions for tonight's conference call. I apologize for that, but I was getting ready to leave the office, and I wanted to make sure it went out. So keep in mind that there'll be 5-minute breaks at the top of each hour as we go through this evening, and that will give you time to take a break and stretch your legs and go to the bathroom, whatever you need to do without missing any of the discussion. The call is being recorded, so those who didn't manage to join for the whole thing, it will be available for playback. We plan to award some prizes at random points, primarily the final hour. And those of you who got the email, you would have been instructed already how to enter the contest. But if you didn't get the email, I'm going to repeat what we sent out in terms of how to enter. You would send a text, which Andy will receive, and he will give you a contestant number. So text Andy at 747-227-4477. That's 747-227-4477. Many of you have already sent your text, but send your text to that number, and we'll confirm that you've been entered, and you'll receive a number, and we will be awarding a couple of Narsil Dice printed newsletter subscriptions and a $50 gift card to a place of your choice. So that pretty much takes care of our housekeeping. I'm going to announce something now that I'm going to also announce later, that we're going to try to launch a new phone call later this month, and the tentative launch date is February 28th, and the time will probably be the same time, 7 Eastern. We're going to have a program called Can They Do That? And that's going to be the initial title, the initial name, and then we're going to suggest things that you might want to rename the program. The program is not going to be to dissect individual cases, but what we are going to try to do is to take questions about things that are being done that you have doubts about whether they can do it. So if the registry verification officers are doing something that you don't think that they should be able to do, we would take that type of question. If the probation parole people are telling you things that seem really over the top, we'll have an attorney or two on the panel, and we will give general responses to can they do that. Of course, the response generally is they can do it until they're told that they can't. So, but we will go a little bit deeper into whether that particular thing might warrant a challenge. So as we develop the program, it'll probably expand beyond those type of questions, but it's not going to be a program where we'll be able to dissect an individual's case and reopen it and go into great detail about what happened that causes the situation that we're dealing with. So I'm going to welcome our panelists. We're going to discuss the case of Commonwealth versus Munez, which is out of Pennsylvania. And we're going to introduce our guest now. I'm assisted here by Teresa Robertson. Hi, Teresa.
Excuse me, Larry. Did you want to record it?
Yes, we do.
The recording has started.
Hi, Larry.
So Teresa, welcome to the call, and thank you for helping.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
So, and then we have two other guests. We have Ms. Leah Bickerton, who's a partner in the Pittsburgh law firm of Bickerton & Bickerton. Since 2005, Ms. Bickerton has concentrated her practice in the area of criminal defense. And for the past 6 years, Ms. Bickerton has dedicated a significant part of her practice to litigating sex offender registration issues. So, Leah, thank you for joining us this evening.
Thank you for having me.
And we're gonna have a lot of questions for you here shortly. And then we have Robert Cincinelli. And we don't have many Cincinellis in New Mexico, so I've been working on that pronunciation. I hope I came close. Mr. Cincinelli has been a member of the Pennsylvania Prison Society for 13 years and has held a seat on their board of directors for 8 years. Mr. Cincinelli is a member of the Prison Society's Public Policy Committee, where he's chaired the subcommittee on sex offense issues since 2013. He sits on the Subcommittee of Conditions of Confinement and has toured many state and county facilities, including Green Rock in Virginia and Muskegon in Michigan, when Pennsylvania was housing its inmates out of state. Welcome, Mr. Cincinelli. Well, we did have Mr. Cincinelli here. So we will endeavor to find
there him. I am. I'm sorry I was muted. Thank you, Larry.
Did I come close on that name?
It's Cincinelli. That's very close.
Okay. So the layout of the program is I'm going to ask some very general questions, a few to Ms. Bickerton, and we've got someone beeping.
That's on my end. I'm sorry.
So I'm going to ask some general questions, and then the more detailed questions are going to go to be handled by Teresa, because Teresa will be far more familiar with what goes on in Pennsylvania. So we are talking to people throughout the nation. There's over 140 people signed up to be on this call, and we're right at 100 right now that have already dropped in here. So there's going to be people in other states. So I'm going to try to concentrate my questions on what this potentially can do for folks in those other states, and then when we hand it off to Teresa, she's going to deal with the specifics of Pennsylvania, and we're going to give preference to those callers when we get to the question session to people who are calling from Pennsylvania. So, Ms. Bickerton, Marshall has been inundated with inquiries regarding the U.S. Supreme Court's denial of cert in this case. Does this effectively put an end to the state's effort to enforce the 2012 amendments?
I wouldn't say that it puts a complete end to their efforts in general. As far as people who were convicted before December 20th of 2012, or people whose offenses are from before December 20th, 2012, this is basically the end of the state trying to use SORNA to have an effect on them. But as we all know, the House bill that's currently working its way through the General Assembly will still try to take some of the parts of SORNA and basically apply it to other individuals. So if you're someone whose conviction came from like after December 20th, 2012, the state is still going to try to impose the conditions of SORNA upon you. But if you're someone where you were retroactively affected by it, then MUNIS should end this particular line of attack that the state has been using.
That was really, I should have refined the question a little bit. That was what I was getting at. Those people who were enhanced in 2012 that were in Pennsylvania, they referred to it, I guess, as Megan's Law, and now what they adopted in 2012, they refer to that as SORNA. So everybody who was in a registration scheme or who had committed offense prior to December 20, 2012, does this effectively end the state's effort to enforce that version on them?
Yes.
Okay. So okay. Our listeners outside the state want to know, well, we're listening to this call tonight, what the heck does this have to do with us? Can you explain what the court found the Pennsylvania's SORNA violates the U.S. Constitution or the state constitution? Because if it only violated the state constitution, only that's going to help Pennsylvania. So what relevance does this have to people outside of Pennsylvania?
Well, I think that where it really helps outside of Pennsylvania is anytime you have some good reasoning, some good logic, and good justification and explanations of people's rights, even though your particular jurisdiction isn't bound to listen to what Pennsylvania has to say, they'll certainly listen to it. So it's considered to be persuasive precedent. It's not something that they absolutely have to listen to, but it's something where if they see that the reasoning makes sense, if their constitution is similar to ours, if their body of case law is relatively similar to what we have going on, that's certainly something that other courts would consider. So it's basically a thing of you don't necessarily want to reinvent the wheel. If you're not in another jurisdiction and you're trying to, you know, find a way to be free from these onerous and punitive measures, then, you know, borrow this wheel from Pennsylvania and use this particular reasoning.
So a court I'll pick a state. In Texas or Louisiana, where conditions, particularly in Louisiana, are harsh. If an attorney in Louisiana were to look at the Muniz decision and see how they reached their analysis, although it wouldn't be binding, all that work that was done there in developing this case, that attorney in Louisiana could certainly say, these are the same factors we have. These enhancements took place here, and when you guys said in 2007 that our registry wasn't a punitive, you weren't considering these factors. They could make those arguments.
Yes, and another argument that I absolutely love is the fact that one of the things that courts look to is to see how communities' ideas tend to shift, how science happens to shift. So one of the reasons why looking at sister jurisdictions comes in handy is that it shows where the general consensus is moving. 10, 15 years ago, it was thought that the registrations and the conditions that were imposed on people, that it wasn't punishment. But now you're starting to see more jurisdictions saying, you know what, looking at what these conditions are, it looks to be punitive to us. The other thing is that a lot of the decisions that came out back in the aughts didn't really address the internet and that particular aspect of it. So where the Pennsylvania decision helps is that it really does go into a lot of great detail about how the innovations in technology since, you know, the 1990s and the aughts, how that shift has made it more punitive. So with that particular aspect of it, not only are you just using the reasoning to show that, you know, it just makes sense, it's also showing how community standards have basically evolved across the country.
So we may have a young person on here. So those who don't know the aughts, that's the zeros. kind of blends into my next question. So for all those listeners across the country, and particularly we've got some legal beagles on this line. We've actually got some attorneys that are on here. So can this litigation serve as a template or model for both our state advocates and for attorneys out there listening on the call that they would want to consider adding to their inventory of precedential and persuasive cases?
Absolutely. I don't think that it's not just that they can use it as a template. I think that they should. You know, if you have the opportunity to pull the briefs and the briefs that were submitted by PACDOL and the other organizations, that's always something that's helpful. But the most important thing is that, again, as I mentioned earlier, you don't want to have to go and reinvent the wheel. Solid legal reasoning is solid legal reasoning no matter what the jurisdiction is. You know, you might have to adjust certain things according to what your particular jurisdiction does as far as some of the more nuanced details, but as far as, you know, the big picture and the ideas as far as ex post facto and that analysis, it is really good analysis that the Supreme Court did in the Muniz decision, and the Wecht concurrence is also very good because there is a little bit of a difference of opinion as far as how the effects of the ex post facto analysis should be, you know, federal versus state, whether the Pennsylvania ex post facto protections are broader than the ones that are offered by the federal government. So in order to get like a really good picture and to get more arguments, you know, definitely read that Wecht concurrence because, again, that is good, solid legal reasoning in the majority opinion and in that concurrence.
Well, I know that NARSL does have the opinion. I'm not sure we have the briefs in our inventory, but that would be good if we could obtain those for the attorneys who would like to see the briefs, because I know this was a great team effort. The Defender Association and a number of it was not a one person operation since 2012 that all the efforts gone into this marvelous victory.
And that's something that you can request those materials directly from the Pennsylvania Superior Courts for the briefs at that level, but also from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. Also, if you have Westlaw access, that's something that you can get from that as well.
So, well, I'm getting near the end of my questions. I'm going to tell you that as cases have unfolded around the country, we inevitably have a lot of experts materialize that were silent, and when the decision comes out, these people materialize and the registered citizens start getting direct marketing about, I'm going to get you off the registry for $2,000 or whatever the case may be. Is this happening in Pennsylvania, and what advice would you give if it is happening?
Okay, I haven't seen that much in the way of direct marketing efforts, but I do know that attorneys are talking about it. But I think that, you know, whether people are being actively sought out with junk mail or whether they're just looking for help, I think that either way, the important thing is to know what your situation is before speaking to an attorney. So the first thing that you have to do is apprise what your situation is. If you're someone who had to register for life under Megan's Law, then, you know, your best bet is just kind of sit this one out and ride it out and see what happens with the House bill. Because ultimately, any type of relief that you would get if you were someone who had to register for life under Megan's Law is just going to really affect being on the Internet and having to come in every quarter. Now, if you are someone of unlimited means and a few months of relief is something that you're willing to pay for, by all means, drop that money. But if, you know, money is an object, if you would prefer to save it, if you're someone who had to register for life under Megan's Law, sit and wait, okay? Now, if you're someone where SORNA retroactively affected your registration, where it took you from someone who had to register for 10 years and it bumped it up to, you know, 15, 25 life, then you have a little bit more wiggle room as far as what you can do. I think that the first step is to be aware of the fact that the state police is going through the list, and anyone who didn't have to register under Megan's Law, but they were brought in under SORNA, they're going through their files and they're trying to find you. They're going to go ahead and review the file and they're going to take you off on their own. For people whose registrations were limited, where it was 10 years and it was increased to life, they're also going to be looking to identify those people independently. So for people where the retroactivity affected your registration length, the state police are actually going in to try to figure out, you know, whether you're entitled to relief. It's a process that can take a while. We've heard estimates anywhere from like 9 months to 16 months for how long this process can take. So if you want to find out if you're one of the people that is on their list, that they're in the process of doing that review, by all means, call the state police and ask if you're one of the people where it's a priority to be reviewed. In the alternative, rest assured that the state police will be reviewing you. So if someone is sitting here trying to tell you, hey, if you pay me, I'm going to get you off in a hurry, unless they're filing a lawsuit to get you a court order, you're not going to be able to go up on the level of priority as far as the state police is concerned. And this brings us back to the entire question, how much is it worth it for you to come off faster rather than slower? If money is a problem, then just wait. The state police will get to you. And if they don't get to you, that's the point that you're going to want to start considering bringing on an attorney to have them take you down.
So, well, that's fantastic news. And the two aspects, first, that the sharks haven't started circling, and that the state police, for those on the call in most states, they have sort of a hybrid model rather than the Pennsylvania model, where the state police is actually the registering entity. but the state police they've made the decision that they're not going to fight this. That they see that this reasoning, this decision will apply to everyone who was in the same circumstances as Munez. That's really good. So we've got that as good news, because in other states they've had to fight tooth and nail. We had to relitigate twice in Maryland to get to the outcome of them deciding they were going to apply it to. Well, actually, we had to get twice to get them to apply it to the first time, because they said it was there was a federal registry. So we had to litigate the case twice to the state's highest court to get relief for people. So this is great news. I've just about wrapped up what I wanted to ask in generalities. Robert, there's going to be questions for you. But before that, did you have any questions or comments you would want to make on what we've covered so far?
I would only say, first of all, it's nice to talk with you, Leah, and to hear that it sounds like everyone is on the same page here in Pennsylvania. As you know, our subcommittee is affiliated with the Defender Association of Philadelphia, so our legal information comes largely from them, and we're hearing exactly the same thing here, and I know they're giving exactly the same advice to all of their clients. Basically sit and wait and let this thing run its course.
There is one group that I think might be an odd exception, and it's people whose convictions are from out of state or federal. I think that they need to make a priority of calling the state police to find out what they plan on doing as far as their particular review.
So out-of-state convictions and those convicted in a federal statutory scheme, they need to take forward action to find out what the state police's opinion is of their situation.
Yes, and I think that their first call should not be to an attorney. Their first call needs to be to the state police.
So, for those, there's been quite a few people joined since we started. We're in the review of the decision. I'm about to hand the call off. Our guests are Leah Bickerton and Robert. Give me that pronunciation again.
Ciccinelli.
And we're gonna turn the call over now to Teresa Robertson from Pennsylvania, and she has many questions. We've actually tried to coordinate our questions so we don't duplicate. So Teresa, this is your section of the call, so proceed with your questions. We did have Teresa here. Well, our producer, do you see Ms. Robertson any longer? Well, then I will take over her question, thankfully. Thankfully, we've coordinated this. So if we can find Teresa, the question was going to be, and we've kind of touched on it already, what options are there for those who occurred prior to December 20, 2012 to get removed from the registry? And what are the pros and cons of each of these options for those? And we've mostly covered on that. But if anything is unclear that you want to expand on, that was her first question.
Okay. Now I think I covered it pretty well.
Okay. So what circumstances may inhibit the ability of those who were arrested pre-SORNA from being moved from the register? So the essence of the question is, anybody whose offense occurred prior to the 2012 application of SORNA. So would a parole violation or probation violation have any impact on their ability to be removed?
SORNA should not have an effect on those people as far as probation or parole violations, because what it comes down to is that because SORNA is punitive, when someone is sentenced, the judge is limited to whatever sentencing options they had available at the time of the original sentencing. So if someone had an offense or conviction from before December 20th, 2012, that the enhanced provisions of SORNA simply just can't be applied because it wasn't an original sentencing option. Where I see a little bit of a potential for, exposure to changes as far as what the obligations are is with this new bill, because it looks like some of the internet components that came into play under Megan's Law 3 and under SORNA are still surviving in this new bill. So as far as, you know, what the issues could be as far as SORNA's concerned, it should be nothing. But this new bill gives me a little bit of heartburn.
So the producer has found Teresa again. So Teresa, welcome back.
Hello.
And we're going to hand the call over to you. And we had just concluded a question. I don't know if you heard which one we were on. But,
I did. Yep.
Okay.
I did. And I wanted to follow up on that question a little bit, though. A few of us were able to go to the Senate Judiciary hearing this past Monday. And one of the things the state police said was that if they went ahead and clearing the list out based on Muniz, the way it stands without House Bill 1952, there would be 9,000 to 12,000 people removed. But if they were pushing, of course, for passage of 1952, and if that's the case, they're saying they would only have to remove 3,000 to 5,000. So that was kind of where that question was coming from, in terms of, you know, how do you jump from 3 to 5 to 9 to 12? There must be some way they're trying to keep these other pre-SORNA folks on the list with that bill.
Well,
can you hold your answer for just a moment?
Okay.
I've gotten a text here, and we haven't done a good job of explaining House Bill 1952 for the people that are not in Pennsylvania. So House Bill 1952 is legislation that's pending since the decision came out last summer that's going to create a registry, and I'll let you guys in Pennsylvania elaborate on it, but they want to find a way to have a constitutional registry. So this is a legislative proposal that's working its way through the process there to reimpose registration obligations. So let's make sure the rest of the country understands what we're talking about when we say 1952. So you guys want to expand on just a little bit before you give the answer that you're about to give, Leah?
Okay, sure. Basically, what they're looking to do is to remedy the issues that were raised with some opinions where they challenged the constitutionality of SORNA / the Adam Walsh Act. And in some ways, it fixes one of the major issues with the retroactivity, which is that it took some people who didn't have to register at all under Megan's Law, and it made them have to register. The other problem is that it took some people who had to register for 10 years and made that registration period 15 years, 25 years life. Now, this proposed bill, although it fixes that particular side of it, which is increasing the duration of the registration, it looks like it's not completely making an adequate fix when it comes to some of the punitive aspects of SORNA, which means having to go in person for updating information, having to let them know if you're going to be traveling for a lengthy period of time, people who are transient having to go in every month, having your information on the internet, letting them know about tattoos, scars, all of that sort of thing. So this proposed bill, this 1952, although it addresses the issue of the increased registrations, it doesn't seem to fix some of the punitive aspects of SORNA, and, you know, some features of Megan's Law 3 were also problematic. If you look at the similarity between that and the SORNA law that was passed in 2012. So that's where right now there's a little bit of a limbo and a question about what is going to happen with the constitutionality of the registry even once this new bill passes. And right now, although the bill has passed the Pennsylvania House, by the Pennsylvania Senate. So, you know, it's just kind of up in the air. So to transition into the question about what the state police was referring to, I actually went through and watched that particular part of the video. Unfortunately, I couldn't watch the whole thing. But it sounds like what the spokesman for the state police was addressing is that under certain interpretations, it looks like there may not be any valid sex offender registration law for people who were convicted and compelled to register before December 20th, 2012. It's an extreme interpretation of the law, but one that I can see the merit for, because what ended up happening is that before we had SORNA or the Adam Walsh Act, we had Megan's Law 3. Megan's Law 3 was in effect from about I want to say January of 2005 until December 19th of 2012. And back in 2013, Pennsylvania Supreme Court struck down Megan's Law 3 because it was unconstitutional, because they didn't enact it in an appropriate way. So where that leaves a little bit of an interesting quirk is that Megan's Law 3 was scheduled to expire back in 2012. Back when the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said that Megan's Law 3 was unconstitutional, they gave a 90-day window for the legislature to go in and fix it. Where this led to a problem is that instead of trying to include some type of a savings clause or to try to reenact some of the portions of Megan's Law 3, it shored up certain problems with SORNA, but did not maintain and go back to fix some of the fundamental issues with Megan's Law 3 because they figured, hey, SORNA fixes the whole thing. So in light of that, what the state police's fear is that all of these people who had to register before December 20th, 2012, there could be an argument that there is no law that makes them register at all. So all those pre-2012 people would have to come off. So when you look at that high figure that they were mentioning, that's where that's coming from, because they're assuming that every single person that had to register before 2012 would come off. So what they're arguing is that they need to try to capture as many of those people that had, like, lifetime registrations, or people who had a registration that had to begin December 18th, 2012, if they had a 10-year registry. If there isn't something to go back and capture those people, even someone who should have had to register for 10 years or life under Megan's Law 3, 2, or 1, would be removed. So that's where we're seeing the discrepancy in the numbers from the state police. It's because he was operating under the assumption that the pre-2012 people would all be coming off.
Okay, that's really helpful. Thanks for that, Leah. So my next question, I think you've already answered, basically was wondering what your guidance would be in terms of time frames, if people should kind of sit tight or move forward, but what you're recommending is sit tight for now for most people.
By and large, right. I'd say sit tight. At the very least, if you do feel like doing something, call the state police to see if you're one of the people that they are reviewing. There are some people, out of an abundance of caution, they still want to get those orders so that way they're taken down. But ultimately, people who were made to register and didn't have to before SORNA took effect, the state police is going to be taking you off. If you're someone who had a 10-year registry and your registration is complete, then the state police, they're going to be trying to find you and take you off. One thing that I can say that the state police has been doing in prior shifts in the law, when something has been deemed to be unconstitutional, once it becomes final, they do a diligent job of going through and trying to find as many people as they can. So I do think that, you know, at first, the most cost-effective approach is just kind of ride it out. If you're someone where your registration period is basically complete, then you're not necessarily going to be harmed by 1952. It doesn't try to keep people whose registration periods have already been completed. So I don't necessarily think that it's not the most cost-effective thing to pay an attorney to try to force this, since the state police are going to try to take care of it on their own. But if you want a fast result, then, hey, by all means, hire an attorney. It's just that if you're looking to save that money, it's best to wait.
Right. Okay, but then that leaves us with the folks whose registration period isn't complete, as well as folks who may still even be in prison on parole and probation. We are here in Pennsylvania are a lot of volunteers and not lawyers, so we're trying to sort this out. And one of the things that's come up is there might be a need for folks to file a PCRA if they still are under the jurisdiction of the court and on the registry. Could you speak to that?
Okay, and if you're someone where your registration is not complete and you're currently serving a sentence, as far as filing a PCRA, one of the things that you have to look out for is, one, assuming that you have to file a PCRA in the first place, look at what the relevant deadline was. It's 60 days from the time that you could have raised that claim. And I think there's a solid argument to be made that the 60-day period started to run back for the, is it Rivera-Figueroa decision that came down in November? That's when they determined that you're eligible for post-conviction relief for SORNA issues. So that's the first thing. Like, if the relevant deadline is 60 days from the Rivera-Figueroa decision, then you're already out of time. So does it hurt to file it just in case? Not really. One of the things to be aware of is that if you're someone where you had to register under Megan's Law, you know, the state police is going to take care of you whether you're incarcerated or not. And if they don't take care of you, then there's an argument to be made that you can file a PCRA then, because the state police has made public representations that they are going to do their own review to remove the people who had to register under Megan's Law and don't have to register under SORNA. So that's where, again, I think that, one, if you were looking to do a PCRA, it's too late already because you're outside of the 60 days from Rivera-Figueroa. The other side of it is that because the state police had already indicated that they are going to remove people, I think that the relevant PCRA deadline is going to be 60 days from whatever it is that the state police decides not to change your registration.
So that would be on an individual basis. If someone's registered 10 years, went from, say, 10 years to life, and then their 10 years expired, say, 6 months from now, and the state police said they weren't going to remove them, then the clock would start ticking for them?
Exactly. Whenever it is that they find out that the state and if the state police's answer is, hey, we haven't gotten to you yet, then it's not until the state police makes it clear that they are not going to put you back to where you should be under Megan's Law that the clock is going to begin to run. Now, of course, none of this is legal advice. It's my opinion
right.
of it.
Yeah, so what is your opinion then in terms of an argument, could there be an argument made that the clock would start ticking on the day that the Supreme Court denied cert for munis?
I think that's – I'm not sure where there would be a legal basis for that particular conclusion because technically it's from when the claim first could have been raised. So if you had a more expansive view of the munis decision, then that 60 days would have started running back in July of 2017. Now, the problem is that because the question of whether munis was retroactive wasn't decided until Rivera-Figueroa, the relevant date is going to be November of 2017. Now, someone can try to say that the clock shouldn't start to run until the munis cert petition was denied, but in my opinion, that's a really terrible legal argument. The clock either started running with Rivera-Figueroa or it doesn't start running until the state police decides not to change that individual person's registration term.
Okay. So thank you. The next question I had was can the living – I think you may have already answered this one, actually. Yeah, it is. In terms of folks from other states and what they might be able to get out of this. Sorry, let me turn my page. I'm on the wrong. All right. So this is more about House Bill 1952. We may have covered this as well. Just let me run through it make sure there's no extra parts. When SORNA was put into effect, my understanding is that it repealed all prior versions of Megan's Law, which you've already covered. What we're wondering is how can the pending proposal 1952 create new provisions for the registry and not be considered ex post facto if it's applied to persons placed on the registry before 2012?
Okay, there are actually two separate questions here. The first thing is that technically the prior versions of Megan's Law weren't repealed. They expired. And there's a little bit of a legal distinction between the two. If you're making, because you know how I mentioned earlier that there's an argument to be made that for people who were convicted before 2012, there's no legal authority to compel them to register at all?
Right.
the only way that that particular line of reasoning works is if you think that those previous laws were actually repealed. If the actual distinction there is that they expired, what that means is that if you're someone who had to register under Megan's Law 2, now Megan's Law 3, that was deemed unconstitutional, so that's a separate argument and one that, you know, I'll get to later or possibly not at all tonight. But the most important thing is to look at for people who had to register under Megan's Law 2. We know that it was a constitutional statute, so it was valid. If there is something that triggered your registration obligation under Megan's Law 2, the fact that the law expired doesn't mean that you don't have to register anymore. It just means that going forward, people had to register under a different regime. So that's where the different, there's a really important distinction between repealed versus expired. If it's repealed, then there's an argument to be made that it's like the registration obligation never happened. But if it just expired, that means that, yeah, you have to register according to what that previous law said.
Okay, that helps a lot.
Okay.
It really helped. It helped me a lot because I messed up this question with my additions because I was under the impression it had been repealed rather than expired. So that helps
probably
me a lot.
Probably got
Thank
that
you.
From me, Larry.
I'm not sure where I got it, but that's typically what they've done, like in Ohio and New Hampshire and places. I think they've repealed. So the distinction of an expired law is helpful to me. Thank you.
Yes.
Okay, my pleasure. Okay, so part two of this is basically with the new, with 1952, how could it not be ex post facto? It all comes down to whether the registration requirements are punishment. If it's something that's merely civil and what they're asking people to do is not so onerous that it rises to the level of being punitive, then, you know, it's a civil restriction. Ex post facto doesn't apply. But if they end up in my opinion, if they push this thing through the way it looks right now, they're running into the same problem that they did with Muniz, because it's what they're asking people to do appears to be similarly onerous. So I think that if it passes in its current form, in my opinion, I think that they're going to run into ex post facto problems again. If they dial some of these restrictions back, especially for the people who were convicted or committed offenses before December 20th, 2012, then they're going to have a lot more leeway with what they can get away with. But, again, what it's going to come down to is, are the conditions punitive? Because if they're punitive, then it doesn't matter that under the proposed 1952, they're going to give people the opportunity to come off the registry after 25 years. But that doesn't fix the fact that what they're doing is making something punitive where it wasn't before.
Okay. That's helpful, too. So what impact can Muniz have on future cases for those arrested post 2012? For instance, since Muniz said that SORNA's registration and online publication provisions place a unique burden on the right to reputation, which is particularly protected in Pennsylvania, shouldn't that remove everyone from the registry?
My short answer is no.
Okay.
Yes. So now the long answer is that when you're looking at something that's punitive, what makes it offensive as far as the Constitution is concerned is if they're trying to make it retroactive. If it's something that they're putting into effect after you've committed the act. Now, for people who committed acts after December 20th, 2012, you're on notice that you're going to have to face the SORNA punishment. So as far as that particular aspect of it, it's not going to help you come off the registry. Now, can you use this as a toehold to make the argument that there needs to be more due process before making you do this because of the right of reputation, and SORNA as currently drafted is deficient when it comes to due process provisions to have someone have this attack on their reputation? That's an interesting argument, and Muniz gives a toehold for that particular train of thought.
So it's something that could be pursued, but it's not something it would need a lot of work and thought going
yes.
forward to use that to move forward.
Yes, I think it's a fascinating argument, and I think that it's a solid one, but it's going to need some litigation.
Mm-hmm. All right. So I think you've already answered the next question in terms of because those of us that have had a chance to look at 1952 or came up with the same conclusions you did in terms of there seems to be an awful lot in the proposed bill that's not constitutional. So we're assuming it won't pass constitutional muster, which doesn't mean it won't be passed into law. Maybe you could speak to how that would be challenged. I mean, would it take another 6 years for someone to challenge it and get through the appeals process as it did Muniz?
My hope is that it wouldn't take that long because Muniz is so clear in what the standards mm-hmm. are and the analysis that they did as far as what the punitive prongs are. There's basically a test right there. So if this law ends up getting passed in its current form, the template is right there. What I would do is I would distill the elements that they used for the ex post facto, the punitive analysis in Muniz, and I would use each part of that to hold that up to what 1952 is proposing to show how what they're doing is still punitive.
Okay, well, that's hopeful. if we do have to challenge it, it won't be drawn out quite as long as Muniz was. So in Commonwealth versus Butler, the Superior Court held that SVP status was unconstitutional because it enhances registration requirements, which violates due process. 1952 does nothing to remedy this violation. It still carries the exact same language of SORNA. So how does 1952 resolve Commonwealth versus Butler?
Well, it can be argued that the provision to terminate the registration requirement after 25 years under petition helps to fix it to some extent. One of the fundamental problems with the SVP determination, well, there are two clear problems that are identified in Butler as far as the SVP determinations. One is the fact that you're taking some people who had shorter registration periods and they turn them into lifetime registrants. So by increasing that exposure, that was a problem. The other issue is that any time you're increasing the punishment and it's based upon a particular fact, it's something that has to be found beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, the 1952 does absolutely nothing to fix the reasonable doubt part. As far as the duration of registration, the fact that it can be terminated after a 25-year period, that I think that makes for an interesting argument to say that, you know what, as far as it changing your registration obligation, that it fixes that particular part of it. Do I agree that it completely fixes, you know, that particular part of it as far as increasing your registration obligation? No, I really don't. But, and one of the reasons why I think that it doesn't is because you're still looking at registration obligations that are punitive. Mm-hmm. But what an enterprising lawyer for the state may argue is that if you're looking at what the Constitution requires, whether it's a procedural type modification versus, you know, changing the punishment itself, then it's not necessarily a problem. So when you're looking at what they're doing here, they're saying, okay, yes, if you're an SVP, you're going to have to register for life instead of 10 years. But it's okay because we found this additional particular fact. But since the registration obligations aren't punitive, we can get away with it because it's not increasing the punishment. So the way that this whole thing is, it's basically operating under the assumption that the registration obligations in themselves are not punitive. Now, if you find the heightened obligations that an SVP has to face as being punitive, then this bill doesn't really help at all.
Can I drill in here a little bit, Teresa, and help out? Those that are in states where they don't have that designation, our friends in Arkansas have that, and several states do, where there's a process to designate someone as a sexually violent predator, which involves a due process determination. Now, how robust and how great that process is varies, but there's a lot of states where people are designated that have a sexually violent offense. Now, we're not talking to those because they're rolling their eyes right now saying, well, I'm a sexually violent offender, but that's by your offense designation. When you talk about the SCP, the sexual violent predator designation, aren't you talking about a procedure that was separate from the registry where there was an adversarial process in a court of law that assigned them that designation? That's what I understand happens in Pennsylvania.
Yes. So in Pennsylvania, if you are convicted of a sexually violent offense, you are supposed to be evaluated by a board that determines whether you're whether you suffer from a mental abnormality that makes it more likely that you're going to reoffend sexually. So it's something where, yeah, you're going to have to register because that's just the way the statute is set up, that, you know, the offense that you're convicted of is going to come with a registration. But if you're also determined to be a sexually violent predator, you're looking at extra things as well. Where this is different from certain jurisdictions is that there are some places where you can actually be determined to be a sexually violent predator or someone who's considered to be have a mental abnormality that makes it more likely that you're going to reoffend. But in Pennsylvania, we tie it to a conviction. You cannot be labeled as an SVP unless you were convicted of an offense. In other jurisdictions, they have mechanisms for civil commitment for people, but they don't have a similar thing in Pennsylvania where it's basically triggered by an offense only. So that's where I'm not sure if it really matters that it's separate from the registry because it's all coming out of the same body of law.
But after they had the evaluation by the board, didn't they go before a court for the actual for the determination, or was it the board that bestowed that title on them as a sexually violent predator?
It is the sentencing court. Basically, before sentence is issued, the court by an extraordinarily low standard determines whether it's more likely than not that the individual is a sexually violent predator, and that's where you have that label.
Okay, so I was just getting at, there was, whatever the process is worth, there is a process. It's not just driven by the offense. And we've got states where you do online solicitation of a minor under 14. That's a sexually violent offense, but yet there's no violence. And people are going to be flooding us with communication because they don't understand this. So, Teresa, I didn't mean to eat your time up, but yeah, I just wanted to clarify that. So go ahead. Thank you.
No problem. I appreciate your input, Larry. Leah, in your opinion, is it possible and or advisable for an injunction to be sought to block 1952 should it pass the Senate in order to halt implementation until the courts can rule on its constitutionality?
I do not foresee any injunction being granted. So at the end of the day, people can file whatever they want, but is the court likely to grant an injunction? No, because in the past, the argument is that until the law has actually affected someone, there's really no controversy to litigate, and they don't offer advisory opinions. So
okay.
In all likelihood, what will happen is that if the law is passed, someone who's affected by it is going to have to sue.
Okay. Do you have any suggestions for those of us in Pennsylvania as to how we might best find other attorneys like yourself who are both knowledgeable about sexual offenses and sexual offense issues and genuinely sympathetic to the need for reform?
To be perfectly honest, without sitting and talking to an attorney, you'll never know if they're legitimately sympathetic to the cause, because they may smile in your face and take your check, but behind your back, not possibly care less about how it affects you as a human being. So as far as finding someone who's truly sympathetic without actual contact with them and without reading what they've written about it, it's really difficult to say. But as far as finding people who have the knowledge and experience, again, it comes down to seeing what they've written, asking about what type of outcomes they've been able to get, questioning them about what they know about the law, the shifts in the law. Someone who is practicing in this area really should be able to tell you the various iterations of the sex offender registration laws, at minimum, going back to Megan's Law 1. Ideally, they can give you the history of the different laws that Pennsylvania has passed to address sex offender issues going back to the 1950s, and to trace, you know, what happened as far as the constitutionality of those particular groups of laws. But, you know, if you have someone who's doing that, they've been reading about this for a very long time. So at minimum, knowing the history of Megan's Law 1 going forward, why is it exactly that the Pennsylvania Constitution keeps on striking down parts of these laws as being unconstitutional? If they're able to discuss these things off the top of their head, then that's a sign that they're knowledgeable. If they can't really address these things, then you might want to run out of the office and go with another attorney.
So we're up on a break time, Teresa, and we're gonna tell everybody that we're gonna be back to resume this interview, both with the two guests, and we're gonna have time for a significant number of questions if we can keep them concise and on point. So we appreciate if you guys, everybody that can stay with us, will stay with us, lay the phone down, and do whatever you're gonna do. And rejoin us at the top of the hour. You'll hear the news sounder again, and we will be on for two additional hours tonight on this special program discussing the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania versus Munez. So see you on the flip side of the break. This is Narsil in action. Be right back.